Welcome to the Humans in AI podcast, powered by AI Frontier Network. I'm your host, Flor Laorga. Each episode, we dive into the human story shaping artificial intelligence through the journeys of entrepreneurs, builders, and leaders. We explore the insights, challenges, and visions for the future of AI and humanity. Let's uncover the human side of AI together. Oh, yeah. Great, Phil. Very nice to meet you. I'm very happy to have you here. Thanks for joining the Humans in AI Show podcast. Yeah, let's start. So let's start a little bit with your journey. You have a background in service operations, but now you are a leader. Actually, you're the Senior Vice President at TaskUs. So yeah, sure, if you can share a little bit of that background.
Yeah, great. First of all, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. My background really began in trust and safety, content moderation, way back in the dark ages of 2011, 2012, where I joined Twitter. My team at Twitter was responsible for the global trust and safety enforcement. So we were the operational arm of the trust and safety team. So really handling global scaled enforcement, handling platform safety and handling things like anti-spam, abuse, harassment. So really, that was my start when it comes to thinking about how technology impacts society and how it impacts the culture and how companies need to build a combination of human and technological solutions to combat the stuff on the internet. So that was really, my entry point. What's interesting is how the evolution of trust and safety over time has that balance between what do humans do, what does AI do, has really shifted, but it remains a conversation and a dialogue between the two. I don't think that's ever going away, frankly. So fast forward to today, where, as you rightly said, at TaskUs, I lead our global offerings team, which is really all of the products and services that TaskUs takes to market. My team are responsible for go-to-market strategy and product strategy. And one of the biggest areas of growth for us right now is what we call AI services. So this is human data services, expert human data services to help companies build better, smarter, safer, faster AI. Our clients are some of the leading large language model developers out in the market. Our clients are some of the leading social media and streaming companies out in the market. All of the companies that we work with, though, are either building AI or are trying to embed AI across their business to create efficiencies, to improve the user experience, to do all sorts of things. So TaskUs provides humans in the loop to help train the data, to help annotate the data, to enrich the data. And that work could be something as simple as annotating an image or a video or a piece of text with a tag or a classifier, up until like open-ended prompt engineering, prompt writing, adversarial testing, very much a consultative, I would call it a complex work type. We do sort of everything between that. And so my job over time, while initially focused on safety and content moderation, has evolved to become more and more focused on keeping AI safe.
Great. So what is the biggest lesson you have learned through that trajectory and that journey as a leader, that leader that you are today at TaskUs?
Well, it's a great question. I think for me, it comes back to technology is not about replacing humans and humanity. It's about allowing humans to reach their full potential. And I think about endeavors like the creative arts and people who make films or music or write books or people who enrich our lives by creating art that goes out into the world. There's some arguments out in the market where people believe that work will be fully automated. Artists and musicians and writers are all going to go away and be replaced by AI. I don't think that's ever going to happen. In fact, I really hope it doesn't, because going back to your question, what's the biggest lesson for me? There are going to be things that human beings are inherently and will always be better at. High relativity, high EQ, high levels of contextuality, things where you need someone to step into the gap that technology has either created or a technology can't meet. And it could be something from a customer service interaction where somebody needs another human being to solve their problem because they need someone with a high level of emotional intelligence and a grounding in sort of the lived human experience that makes us who we are. to be able to solve it. But then there's going to be stuff that technology is going to be much better at, right? High scale, low complexity, repeatability, lots of messy data that you need to organize into a readable format, be able to spot patterns and insights across large, incomplete data sets. That's great. Technology will always be better than humans at that. And it never sleeps. It never needs a break. It never needs to go to the bathroom. So I think really, when I think about your question, what's the lesson? The lesson is really about deploying your technology in a way that elevates human potential and doesn't nullify it. And making sure that when you are using technology in your business to solve problems, that it's being used in a way that is grounded in common sense versus a sledgehammer approach where you're just going to put AI across every single business process and hope for the best.
Okay. So in your role overseeing AI services, what does building a human-first AI operation look like to you?
I think it starts with great understanding of what does good look like, right? So when a client comes to us with a piece of work, a problem statement, we need to understand what does success look like for them. Are they building a model that is going to help autonomous vehicles drive more safely, for example? Or are they trying to build a AI detection model that will find bad content on a social media platform? Okay, if so, what does good look like? Is it about removing the most amount of content with the least amount of false positives or false negatives? Or is it about getting the car safely from point A to point B without any incidents or any accidents? So really it starts with, I think, a very clear understanding and a lot of dialogue about what is the scope and then what is your measure of success. Once you understand what that is, you can start to understand what type of human expertise do I need? Do I need human beings who are really good at annotating LIDAR and radar and camera images to stop your autonomous vehicle from driving off the road? So you need people with experience in computer vision work, and you need people with high degree of pattern recognition and high attention to detail. Or do you need people who are going to be able to understand what is hate speech in languages like Mandarin and Pashto and Swahili so that they can understand and train the model to operate better in multiple languages? So again, it's about understanding scope, understanding what good looks like, finding the right people to come in and deliver whatever good looks like. And that dialogue with our clients, which starts before the project is even launched and it continues all the way through to the project's end, I think that's key for us.
Okay, so talking about clients, how do you balance automation with empathy in digital customer experiences?
I don't think that's a solved problem, so I can't speak from a position of authority. I could tell you that the process I would recommend people take is one of test and iterate, right? There's no such thing as a plug and play, plug it in and hope for the best. So what I mean by that is, let's say you have a customer service, agentic AI, conversational AI, that is interacting with your customers in real time. You need to be constantly looking at the outputs. You need to be constantly looking at the CSAT scores as they correlate to those outputs. You need to constantly be looking at the feedback that you're getting both from your customers in real time as they're interacting with your product, but also maybe on second or third party websites like Trustpilot or Google App Reviews or whatever else, and bringing all that data in and saying, okay, we think we're solving the problem because our metrics are in the green, but what are our customers really telling us? And optimizing really for what you think they're really telling you, as opposed to what you think good looks like based on just your data on your side of the firewall. It's test and iterate, fail fast, be prepared to be wrong, and constantly listen to your customers and build that into your next version or your next update.
Yeah, so I actually need mentioning this thing about you said failing fast. So do you think that Task Us have startup culture or more corporate culture?
That's a great question. I would say our DNA is really rooted in kind of an entrepreneurial startup approach. But we have to remember, we're a company of 60,000 employees. It's very hard to be scrappy and agile and nimble and fast when you have 60,000 employees in 30 offices around the world. So it's a balance. I would say, you know, our clients expect us to be agile and nimble and responsive to their needs. Our clients expect us to see around the corners and to provide them insights and data points and look ahead into the future so that they can protect their own businesses. But they also expect us to run a strong operational foundational business where we are, so to speak, keeping the lights on, keeping the ship steady, be running it in a predictable way. So it's a little bit of both, Floor. And I would say the balance for us is trying to be agile and nimble, but at the same time, not breaking too many eggs in the process.
Yeah, it's completely understandable because I kind of check it and your company is pretty big though. So it's kind of, yeah. So I saw that first of all, it was like a startup, then it was a public, then it's now again, it's private. So that's how I was confused. That's why thank you very much for showing me.
Just to double click on that. So TaskUs began as an outsourcer to startups. So, you know, our founders, Bryce and Jasper, this is now back in 2008, 2009, when they looked around at the outsourcing landscape, they saw there was a lot of outsourcers who were serving what I would call traditional business segments. So think about like large healthcare or telecommunications or insurance or large banking financial institutions. There weren't really any outsourcers who were specializing in the needs of this new breed of digital-only companies, app-based companies, I would call it, who at the time were new and exciting, and companies like Uber and Facebook and others were popping up and starting to make waves, but had not yet adopted the position in the kind of global market, global economy that they have today. Whereas today they are the largest companies in the world driving huge amounts of economic activity. At the time, it was not quite the same, right? This is 15, 16 years ago. I think the company was founded on the idea that, okay, if you're going to be an outsourcer to the startups, you have to look and feel different to some of the other outsourcers. And like I said, that's our DNA. But to your point, as you grow into a public company, you grow into a company with tens of thousands of employees and hundreds of different clients in all sorts of different parts of the world, you need to then start building a foundation and a base of a very core, strong operating model. And it's always a balance. I like to think that we get it right most of the time, but it remains a kind of a delicate balance that we have to strike.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for the clarification. I appreciate that. Can you share a moment or time when TaskUs had to change process or product because of the AI capabilities or ethical considerations that it didn't happen before, but now you had to take in consideration?
Yeah, it's such a great question. I can think of times where we have had to decline working with certain types of clients because of ethical considerations. I'm not going to name the names of the companies, but I can give you an example. At one point, we were approached by a company that was involved in the adult entertainment industry, very large company. I come from a background of trust and safety where, you know, yes, the adult entertainment industry is not perfect, but there is a strong counter argument from within the industry that it provides safe work for sex workers, that it provides access to economic empowerment, that despite some of the challenges, the adult entertainment industry can help uplift certain parts of the communities. That's not the full picture, but that is one point of view. And me and my team who came from that world were advocating for, well, there is a world in which TaskUs can help this company in an ethical, in a safe way, provide the kinds of services like age verification and getting rid of non-consensual nudity or revenge porn, as it's called, or keeping these platforms safer and more accountable. I think the counter argument to that was that, you know, in some countries where our company has a lot of workers, like the Philippines and India, there is a lot of cultural stigma and societal stigma around working for adult entertainment companies, but that would make a lot of our teammates uncomfortable. And as a result, we ultimately decided not to do this work with this company because we wanted to put our teammates and their feelings first. And I think ultimately, even though it was my team advocating for this work to begin with, we ultimately made the right decision for our teammates and for our company.
Whoa, very good. Talking now about more about safety, about AI safety. What is the role of human experts in building and keeping AI safe, in your opinion?
Yeah. So the world of AI safety is really an emerging field within the broader kind of AI services, as we call it. This is primarily the work of helping companies build AI products that are ethical, that are safe, that are harmless, and that are ultimately aligned with human values. Humans do a number of things to achieve those goals. So we've we speak about human in the loop. So what does that mean? When, for example, an LLM is launched into the market, you will have humans, teams of people at companies like TaskUs, test the model to see if they can get it to break. So they adopt an adversarial approach. They call it red teaming or black hat, where you attempt to actually get the model to say something or do something that's inappropriate or that's wrong. And there's all sorts of techniques in order to do that. Prompt inversions or a scenario-based kind of prompting, or you basically adopt sort of a hacker mentality and you try to get the model to break. So that's a very important part of human in the loop as it relates to AI safety. It's the work of checking to make sure the model doesn't do what it's not supposed to do by trying to get it to do the bad thing. And then when you do get it to break, you document it, you write up the chain of thought reasoning that got you to that place, and you share that back with the product team so that they can go and close that loophole. So that's one thing. Another piece of work that we're doing today is looking at users of the LLM platforms who are maybe creating multiple accounts to circumvent rate limit controls, or who are using these models to try generate illegal content, synthetic or AI-generated CSAM, child sexual abuse material. So that instead of looking at the model itself, you're looking at the behavior of the users or the actors who are trying to do something bad and taking action on them, suspending their account or limiting their account, or maybe sometimes even reporting them to law enforcement. So there's all sorts of things that human beings do to make these models safe. And I think it's a new field, an evolving field, and a very exciting field at the intersection of trust and safety, AI, and the broader societal push towards innovation that this technology has brought.
So since we're talking a lot about trust and safety, I would like to understand, what is trust and safety for you?
Yeah, the clue is really in the name, right? It's trust. Ultimately, many large platforms rely on the trust of its users, but not just its users. They need trust from businesses who spend money to advertise on those platforms. They need trust from regulators that they are not falling foul of global laws and norms. They need trust from all different parties in order for them to occupy this kind of lofty position in the social consciousness and in our economy. So the work of trust and safety is ensuring that the platforms can remain trustworthy to all of its different stakeholders. So that's one piece. And then the other piece, safety, is really about limiting or removing harmful content on these platforms. So those two things, while interconnected, are slightly different. So really, trust and safety as a practice is the work of ensuring trust and ensuring safety on the platforms. And usually the work is grounded in a set of laws or constitutions or terms of service of the platform. Some platforms are more permissive. So for example, a platform like X, even while I was there and it was still called Twitter, allowed adult content on the platform and allowed certain types of speech on the platform that maybe someone like Meta, which was at the time called Facebook, or someone like Snapchat wouldn't allow. So platforms have different tolerance levels and different, I guess, attitudes or appetites for risk. But ultimately, there is some stuff that is illegal and no platforms want to have it on it, right? You think about violent extremism, you think about child safety, you think about incitements to violence, you think about all sorts of stuff that most countries, most jurisdictions, not only frown upon, but it's illegal, right? The work is really beyond just making these platforms trustworthy and safe. It's also making sure they comply with local and international rules as it relates to content and it relates to speech.
Okay. How do you see the role of AI in this field of trust, safety, and ethics?
Yeah, it is absolutely fundamental and crucial, and it's only getting more fundamental as the time goes on. Going back to my starting days in trust and safety 15 years ago, AI was already being used to find bad content on the platform. Things like spam, which I know it sounds weird now, it's a throwback, but that was a massive problem. If any of your listeners remember the Twitter of 2011, 2012, Reddit or Digg, or even the comment section of your favorite news site, you'll remember it was full of spam, people trying to sell all sorts of weird drugs or pills or medicine or homeopathic remedies, right? That has a very detrimental effect on the user experience on these platforms. That's an example of one of the first harm types that was really automated. 15 years ago, companies were building models to detect spam. Spam is a numbers game. It's people trying to post millions and millions of messages across as many channels as they can, hoping they get one click, one conversion, because it's ultimately a financially incentivized harm, right? You're trying to get people to spend money, or you're trying to defraud people somehow. The work of automating how to detect more complex harm types, things like hate speech, things like grooming, things like abuse, things like any type of nuanced interaction-based harms, that's harder. And then again, the work of detecting harmful content within video or images requires more computing power, because you have to have a way to scan through this, whatever's in the image or the video. You need more processing power. So as a result, 15, 20 years ago, it wasn't really possible to do high-scale AI-powered detection of bad content in videos and images. That's really changed. So in the last several years, many platforms have real-time content detection on text, audio, image, video, multimodal content as well, at the point of content creation. So if you or I go to Meta, for example, and upload a photo or upload a video or upload an audio, before it's even posted, it's gone through the Meta's AI, and it's, if there's something in there that's bad, it's not going to be allowed to be posted, or it will be removed as soon as it's posted. AI is playing a fundamental role at the top of the funnel. Now, what's interesting is stuff that gets flagged by the AI when it gets created is still being passed to human beings for a second review or a final review, so to speak. 10, 15 years ago, most platforms relied on user reporting. So you or I had to see something bad on the platform and go, oh, I don't like that, and click report. That would then go to a team of human moderators at that company who would then look at the content and make a decision. Today, I would say upwards of 90%, maybe 95% in some platforms, that content is already being flagged by AI before a human ever sees it. It doesn't require another user to report it, but it's still being sent to a human moderator for a final review because of the challenges we spoke about earlier. There's a lot of contextuality. There's a lot of nuance. There's a lot of local interpretation that has to be considered before we make an enforcement decision of removing a piece of content or leaving it up.
Okay, that was a very complete answer. Thank you. I know that you are so mental health advocate, right? Like, you give a lot of importance to mental health. I actually love this topic because I also believe so. In this era of AI, everything is happening so fast. Things are moving very fast. There's a lot of fears that as well of like AI replacing your job, blah, blah, blah. So there's, how do you foster a culture that supports psychological safety for your team?
Yeah, such a great question. Thank you for asking it. You're right. I have been a vocal advocate for better mental health support in the workplace. I think this stems from my own experiences working through my 20s and 30s at great companies, don't get me wrong, but really the idea that you would provide mental health support to your employees was, people didn't even think about it. And I remember going back to my time at Twitter, great company, very people first, very culturally aligned, very value aligned with my own personal values. But the idea of moderators needing very special types of interventions and access to specialized services and more time off and just more of a sort of understanding approach, it just wasn't there. And it's not because Twitter was a bad company. It's just nobody was thinking that way at that time. The learning had not evolved to that point. When I look at how do companies today who run content moderation teams operate, these are some of the most highly cared for, supported operations teams in the world. TaskUs, for example, I have a team within my group of over 200 clinicians, psychologists, psychotherapists, counselors, mental health professionals all around the world who are providing on-demand 24/7 psychological health and safety services to our 12,000 employees, 12,000 content moderators around the world. These folks get specialized training. They get ongoing access to groups and brain-based training. They get ongoing access to one-to-one on demand as needed. They get special dispensation for time off. They get special screening before they join the company to make sure that they're suitable to this type of work. They get support even after they leave the company. They have access to these services. it's a whole different world, right? While I still think we have a long way to go as a society and as employers, and we should always strive to be better, it's night and day today versus what it was 10 or 15 years ago. And I think it's for the better, and applaud organizations and groups like the Trust and Safety Professional Association, who have really advocated and have allowed the industry to take a collectivist approach as to this problem, which ultimately it's a case of a rising tide has to lift all the boats, right? And if one company fails and another one succeeds, that's not right. The analogy I always use for is, you know, the guy who invented the seatbelt, I think he was a technician working for Volvo in the 1960s. Volvo and this guy had a choice to make. They could patent that and allow no other cars to use it. They actually chose to give it away to allow all cars to benefit from this innovation, because they thought, what's the point of Volvo drivers being saved, but everyone else is going to be terribly injured in an accident? I think we need to take and have taken a very similar approach, in the sense that best practices, new innovations, new technologies, new ways of working are things that we need to almost open source to the world and say, hey, we figured out a way to help content moderators be safer in their jobs. We think everyone should benefit from that. So certainly in the case of Taskus and many of our peers in the field, we've seen research be published and peer-reviewed academic journals. We've seen next week, as we're recording this in San Francisco, there's going to be TrustCon, which is the big trust and safety annual conference. Tons of discussion and collaboration between mental health professionals across all swathes of the industry. I think having the industry come together and coalesce around this very important topic has been wonderful to see. I'm glad Taskus has played a small part in that. And I'm certainly going to continue to push and advocate, and I'm sure the rest of the industry will too.
Okay, I'm happy to hear that you guys on Taskus and everybody is kind of working good with working on the mental health theme. That I think is a very important topic, actually.
Yes.
I would like to talk a little bit about your leadership style. How does your leadership style reflect on the way that, for example, on the mental health or taking care of your team, or the way that you take care of the team, basically?
It's a good question. I'm not perfect, and I'm always trying to learn and get better, but there are a number of principles that I try to operate within. For a start, I trust my team. If someone says to me, hey, Phil, I need a day, or I need an afternoon, or hey, I need a whole month off because I'm struggling, I trust that they're making the right call for themselves. And I'm not going to ask someone to give me the details of what's going on in their life and why they need it. I'll just say, okay, I trust you. I'll see you in a week, or I'll see you in a month, or I'll see you tomorrow. You take the time you need. So I think starting from a place of trust and assuming the best intentions of everyone around you, unless you've proven otherwise, is a great starting point. I like to do that. When I was younger and in my career, I had a tendency to micromanage a little more. I think many young leaders and new leaders do. It's a sense of control and a sense of not what you can't see, you don't understand. So for me, learning to let go and really hire great people and then trust them to do great work and not have to be micromanaging every project or every objective, I think that has been a big learning for me as I've gotten a little older and a little deeper into my career. And I think expect the same from my boss, right? They don't micromanage me. I go to them when I need help, but for the most part, they expect me to just drive my own car, operate my own ship, and ask for help as needed. So I do the same with my teams. I think the other thing for me as a leader and as an individual, yes, it's important to me that Taskus and any company that I work for succeeds and grows and meets its goals. Yes, it's important for me to help the company be successful in a crowded market. None of that means anything if I'm not helping my team members achieve their own personal career goals and their own milestones. I think the best compliment I can hear from a teammate or from a colleague is that they feel like they've grown into a better person, a better leader, and they've done the best work of their career while on the team. That for me is a sign that's really what success means. And I think you can have both, right? You can create a team culture of accountability and growth and success and very objective and goal-based, but you can do it in a way that people feel like you have their back, that you are working with their best interests at heart, and that you ultimately want them to succeed as individuals and as leaders. So I think for me, that's what I like to focus on. And I think the last thing I'll say on this is that everybody's different and everybody needs different things. Taking a blanket approach to every person in your team, some person might be an introvert who needs a lot of validation. Another person's an extrovert who just needs, you just need to clear the way for them. It's a different approach, ultimately rooted in the same set of values. But I think taking a custom approach to each person on your team is, I found that to be probably the best way to approach it.
Thanks for sure. As well as you are a mentor for someone from your team, right? And a leader. So in your own leadership journey, who has been, or have you ever had a mentor?
Yeah, I've had several. I think of some leaders that I've worked with, going back to Twitter, where I was raw. I was still learning my way. I had led and built teams in previous companies, but the challenge had amplified by the time I got to Twitter. I'd never been in a company with that much high growth, but also in a company that had there was so much at stake, because we used to wake up every day and Twitter was in the news. Whether it was a tweet that someone had sent that is now part of the news cycle, or something the company itself had done or the founders had done. I'd never been in a spot like that where there was so much of a spotlight on. And working within the trust and safety team, you'd make a decision on Wednesday and on Thursday, it would be in the news. I'd never seen anything like that before. So for me, I had some mentors at Twitter who helped me to understand how to do that work in a safe and sustainable and meaningful way, how to be true to our values, but also how to push back and hold our stakeholders across the business accountable. There's always a classic kind of tension in a trust and safety group between the policy team and the operational team, the team who writes the rules and the team who has to enforce the rules. I think it works best when there's some healthy tension between those two groups. And we certainly had some of that at Twitter, and I was able to navigate that with the help of some mentors. I'll fast forward then to my time at TaskUs. For my first year at TaskUs, I had the great privilege of reporting to our CEO, Bryce Maddock. And Bryce is probably, you know, 5 or 6 years younger than me. So this is my first experience actually reporting to someone who was younger than me. And I learned so much from him about entrepreneurship, about bootstrapping a company, about taking a vision and backing it and really holding yourself accountable. And I continue to look to Bryce to this day for that mentorship and guidance. And so, yeah, those are just two examples, but I've been lucky to have mentors both within work, but also in my personal life that have really helped me grow.
I think mentors are always very important though. So talking a little bit more about a vision and TaskUs, what kind of future that you envision about TaskUs, like from 5 years now?
Yeah, we want to be the premier provider of tech-enabled specialized services to innovative tech companies in the world. That's really what we want to be. We want to make sure that we are the first choice for companies trying to solve hard problems when they need help, whether that help is customer service, or it's complex AI enrichment, or it's trust and safety, or it's go-to-market services, or whatever else in between. That TaskUs is the company that's seen as the leader and the expert. So that really is the vision for us as a company. I would say more granularly, I think helping the most innovative companies in the world today, many of whom are operating in this AI space, right? So the foundational model builders, the large Fortune 100 tech companies that are building AI-powered products across their whole suite of kind of their whole ecosystem. I want TaskUs to be the company to really provide that like expert layer, humans in the loop, high data quality, accountability, safety, guardrail management that helps these companies deploy that technology safely and ultimately allows that technology to drive their business to success. I think of us as we're like an ingredient, right? We're not going to be the ones building our own models. We're not going to be the ones building our own technology to go compete with Google or OpenAI or Meta or whoever. We're going to be the secret ingredient that's, I think of the analogy like the Gore-Tex that goes into your waterproof jacket, right? We're the secret ingredient, but one that's fundamental to the operation of that technology. That's really what I hope for Taskos. And I hope we can do that in a way that continues to elevate our frontline, our teammates, our 60,000 and more teammates around the world, keep them happy, fulfilled, safe, and ultimately building their careers with Taskos and allowing them to feed their families and to expand their own horizons. A big part of what we do is creating jobs and careers for thousands of people around the world. That's a great mission to wake up every day to, and I hope we can continue to do that.
Wow. Thanks for sharing. Now we are already almost at the end. I would like to ask you more like an open question about if you would like to give an advice to the young entrepreneurs or leaders who are starting their career now, if you want, or anything else that you would like to share with the audience.
I think of what would I tell a 25-year-old Phil Tomlinson back in the day? I think there's a couple of things I'd say. Number one, don't work for a company if you don't feel like you are valued as a person. If you are just an input, if you are just a cog in the machine, if you are just another brick in the wall, so to speak, and you don't feel like this is a company that values your individual personality, your humor, the things that make you, it's probably not the right company for you. So I would say I spent some time in my early career working for companies that probably weren't the right company for me. Even though I liked aspects of the work or I liked some of the people I worked with, I didn't feel valued at those companies. And I probably, if I could go back in time, I would leave those jobs probably a little sooner than I did. So that's one thing I would say. When I think about more from like a visionary point of view, if someone's an entrepreneur looking to get started, it's an amazing time to be an entrepreneur. People are building companies from scratch. You have the technology at your fingertips, and it's not free, but it's very cheap. For a couple of $100 a year, you can have access to all these AI augmented tools that can help you build apps, that can help you build a sales flow, that can help you do lead qualification. If you're a young entrepreneur looking to get started, pick a problem that's out in the world that you have experienced yourself and you understand, and build something to solve that problem and see where it takes you. And you don't need a team of engineers anymore. You don't need a sales team anymore. You don't need a marketing team anymore. A single entrepreneur on their own can build a business and run with it. And if they find the right product market fit, if they find the right gap in the market, there's a huge amount of success out there. I would encourage people to give it a go while they can. I look at myself and where I am in my career now. I would love to be able to do more like that. I'm at a different stage of my career where I have a day job. But if I could go back again to if I was 22, 23, 24, I'd probably encourage myself to be a little more entrepreneurial, knowing that even if you fail, you'll learn and you have time to find, if you need to go back into a corporate job and find something a little more steady, you have time. So that would be my advice to people.
Thanks, Bill. I actually really like it, like the both parts. I think that's very important to follow your persona, your identity, and feel belong to somewhere, not just do, and just life is short. So just do it.
Absolutely.
Okay, Phil, I personally have an amazing time with you here. I think the conversation was very smooth, for me at least. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Humans in AI podcast. We are here to spotlight the people making AI more human, one story at a time. See you in the next episode.